This is a Sound Rebel podcast.
To work with us on your podcast, go to soundrebel.co.uk.
Before we get into this week's episode with Michael Sargood, happy without the hooch, we just wanted to let you know that during the course of this episode, we talk about mental health issues and there are references to suicidal thoughts as well. If you decide that this episode is not for you, we completely understand and we look forward to you listening same time next week.
Influence is no longer just a podcast. Our online community is buzzing with people like you.
Hi, it's Danny. I'm 45. I'm from Manchester. I joined the OTI community in October 21. I was sceptical at first because I'm not on any sort of social media, and I've been in a couple of other very large online sober communities before. I was amazed right from the offset the involvement that Shaz and Ben have in the community. I thoroughly enjoy the Zoom calls, and I've met some pretty good pals along the way that I didn't realise I was in the market for. We've been out for hikes. It's just great. I've been in touch with like-minded people, and it really has been a game changer. So I'd encourage anybody to give it a go.
You've heard the podcast. Now join the conversation. Go to overtheinfluence.co.uk.
Welcome to this week's episode of Over the Influence. It's really, really good to have you listening. Quick introductions or reintroductions as to who we are. My name is Sharon Hartley. I live in Lancashire in the northwest of England. I took a break from booze nearly 6 years ago. Crikey, nearly 6 years ago. It was only ever meant to be a break. I was going to get fully back on it because I thought sobriety would be crap. I thought life without alcohol would be dull and boring. It's not. It's a gift. It's the best thing ever. And in answer to the question, which I don't get asked that often these days, actually, how much did you drink? How bad did it get? Well, I drank too much, too quickly, far too often, and it got bad enough for me. I'm really, really chuffed that alcohol no longer features in my life. And I'm 50 as well, if you were wondering. Ben Anderson, how old are you?
How old am I? That's a really good question. I am 36 after birthday. I'm Ben. I live in Liverpool. I gave up booze just over 4 years ago. And since then, yeah, well, look, for me, removing alcohol, I didn't mean to do it for this long. I meant to do it for 3 months. That became six. That became 12. I got to 12 months and went, oh, this is really good for me. I'm going to carry on. And now 4 years into it, you know, we're talking about it on the premium podcast this week, Sharon, weren't we? You know, for many reasons, removing alcohol, it still pays dividends for me to this day. You know, we say it all the time. Removing alcohol, it's a gift when times are good. But it really pays dividend in tougher times. And, you know, for me, I'm so grateful that I've got that kind of alcohol-free foundation. And everyone builds different things on that foundation. I think for me, it just really helped me to be the best dad, husband, colleague at work. You know, it helps me to be the best version of me that I can be. So very grateful for removing alcohol. And yeah, can't believe it was over 4 years ago now. Nuts.
Amazing. Ben, thank you. I'm dead chuffed that we've got today's guest joining us on the podcast. And it feels like this should have happened years ago, but it didn't. But we've got there anyway now. We are delighted to welcome Michael Sargood, who is very, very happy without the hooch to Over the Influence. Michael, thank you for your time. How the hell are you?
I'm dandy, a little bit hot and sweaty, a bit overheated. I'm not going to complain, though, because everyone's been saying how rubbish the summer's been. But I lived in Yorkshire for 14 years, so, and I'm now in Southend-on-Sea. And if they want to know what a rubbish summer is, then go to North Yorkshire or Scotland, even worse. So, I'm struggling. I'm struggling in the heat.
I feel your pain. It's really good to have you on the pod, so thank you. I've just got to share this before we get into our chat. I was messaging you last night on Instagram, you know, just with some tech stuff or looking forward to chatting tomorrow, and Michael was like, I'm out, I'll respond later. And it was like, I think you replied at like 25 to 12, and I'm thinking, the guy's sober. What is he doing? We go to bed early. I mean, Michael's spill.
Well, I haven't really transformed my sleeping habits that much since going sober. I know, like, there's this this whole you've got to get up at 5 a.m. nonsense. Well, no, you don't. You can still have a bloody good lion. Sometimes I go to bed early, and often I'm still just lying there then doing word puzzles or whatever until it's 2 a.m. You know, I often don't sleep until 2 a.m. And that's something that's probably not going to change. I try and get myself into a healthier habit, but you know what? I still have the same amount of hours awake as anybody else who's getting up at 5 a.m. And an early start wouldn't really suit me because my partner doesn't have one. And I know a lot of people where they're in these mismatched relationships now. They've started getting up at 5 a.m. Since they've gone sober, and their partner isn't. And they're going to bed at 9 a.m. when the good TV starts, and they don't see their partner anymore. Sometimes that means their relationship's improved. But yeah, I haven't hacked that one. Also, I like the nighttime. It's quiet. Well, depends where you go. But I've recently started running, but I don't go at 5 a.m. in the morning. I go at like after 11 p.m. when no one's around to see me gasping for air at half a mile an hour. That's my preferred time. It's nice and cool. Because I'm a sweaty Betty, I still overheat. And yeah, I like to hear the seagulls and the drunk people in the distance. So yeah, it's perfectly possible, I've discovered, to be a night owl, but not partake in any of the nonsense.
Love that. Thank you so much. Tell us a bit about you. I'll kick off by mentioning the fact that you are 3.5 years alcohol-free, which is absolutely fantastic. Tell us about you, Michael, before you made that decision to remove the booze.
I've had what I thought at the beginning was a pretty British relationship with alcohol. You know, it's normal for the UK. And I'd binge drink at the weekends. I was a late blossomer. I didn't really touch alcohol until I was nearly 18. I sort of kind of waited to be legal, which is unheard of. And I came from a family. Well, my dad's 73 and I've still never seen him drunk.
Wow.
So, and I've never really appreciated what a gift that is, but I know other people now have had very different experiences of their fathers. So booze wasn't really a factor in my life. I sort of smelt it or tried a little bit at a party and thought it was disgusting. And I was quite happy to wait until I was 18 to force myself to try and keep some down. That said, there have been alcohol problems in my family, on my mother's side of the family, the Scottish side, all just rolling around the floor drunk in their free time. And I know that had caused my mum a lot of pain over the years. She left home as soon as she could. She applied for a course at university that wasn't offered locally, not because she wanted to do the course, but because it meant that she could get accommodation away from home. And I know, because my mum and dad were together from like the age of 16, that was one of the things that had caused my dad not to drink, just having to go over and pick up my mum and see the state that her parents were in, fighting and the abuse that went with it so often. And my dad said to me, I don't drink because I hate not feeling like I'm in control. And then when I had my first drink at nearly 18, I thought, I bloody love this drink. I feel like I've got no control. So what he hated about it was what I loved about it. It's just, I'd always taken a dim view. I'd adopted my father's dim view of alcohol and smoking. And then I tried drinking and I thought, oh, it's been keeping this secret from me. This is bloody amazing. I think I'll have some more of that. All of a sudden, all these hang-ups and insecurities I have just vanished, and here I am singing and dancing on a table. It's like, what a wonderful magic potion this is. I think I will continue doing this as much as I can. But yes, stopping was always a problem. I managed to confine most of my drinking from my 20s to weekends until my late 20s. And I've been in an unhappy relationship, let's say. And I plan to get out of it with my best friend, Juliet. And then suddenly She was taken to hospital with some pains and she'd passed away within a week. And she was the only person I was ever able to confide with. She was also my get out plan for this relationship. And I just thought, that's all gone now. And so on the way home, I picked up some, a small bottle of gin. And then I did that every day. And then the bottles got bigger. And I eventually got out of that relationship and things were all good with the new relationship. It was happy, but that the habit was set and I found that hard to stop. And the consequences just got worse and worse. My weekends got longer. They used to be Saturdays, you know, Friday nights and Saturdays, maybe Sunday. Then Thursday became the new Friday. And then Wednesday became the new Thursday. And then all of a sudden, the only days I'm not drinking are Monday and Tuesday. And then I started getting the shakes on the Mondays and Tuesdays. So I drink to stop the shakes on Mondays and Tuesdays to start the proper drinking between Wednesdays and Sundays. And that's when I got a physical addiction as well. Although I'm always keen to emphasize to people that the physical addiction is tiny compared to the psychological addiction. You can get alcohol out of your system in a week. You can detox in a week, but the psychological side, breaking that habit and finding new ways of navigating the world, let's say, those take a little longer to adjust.
Michael, you know, whenever anyone says anything like you've just talked about and physical addiction, we've got to do what we've got to do and say, you know, if you think that you might be physically dependent on alcohol, you've got to, you've talked about detoxes there, you've got to talk to your GP. You know, it can be fatal to stop drinking immediately. Yeah. If you are physically dependent on alcohol, it's a really interesting point you make, you know, in terms of that longer term. I mean, can I ask, where are you now? You know, we'll go back again. We might do kind of a bit of time hopping throughout the course of this chat. But, you know, how do you feel now?
I feel content. And I feel a lot more grounded, I suppose. Emotionally before, I was a bit of a wreck. I wouldn't acknowledge to having emotions. But then again, you know, anger, resentment, jealousy, all these horrible things I felt on a daily basis were emotions. It's just they weren't positive ones. I always thought, oh no, I don't have emotions. Emotions to me was sort of airy fairy, fluffy, love and joy and tears. But I was up and down constantly. I'd have massive highs and then absolutely hellish lows. And I would very rarely sort of be for very long at a place between those two. Because I'd emerge from the hellish lows and I'd be able to pick myself up immediately for a couple of hours of sort of bliss with alcohol before it then all descended back towards the hellishness. I'd drink, I'd get that real high until I was unconscious and then I'd wake up feeling like death with resentment, shame, guilt, trying to work out what I'd done the night before. And that was a cycle. I'd never found that happy medium. And now I get highs and lows, but the highs aren't as high, the lows aren't as low. The highs are real, so they're harder to gain, harder fought, but they're real and authentic when you get them. And the lows, they're not half as low, and I'll recover from them a lot quicker. It's just like a gradual undulation rather than this yo-yoing between extremes.
We talked about this for two. What was the lovely American man called, Chaz? You'll have to remind me. The really lovely American fella with the world's happiest face. Do you remember he had the great Zoom background? Oh, God, I feel terrible. We didn't see so many people, Michael. Please forgive me.
Was it Justin B. Long?
No, it wasn't. His name started with A. Oh, God, I feel terrible for not remembering it. But we talked about exactly that kind of the feeling of contentment.
Austin Kerr. Austin. Sorry to interrupt.
Austin.
Sorry.
Fabulous guy. And we talked about exactly that contentment, you know, how comfortable and how fabulous contentment is. Because is it not boring, Michael? You know,
sometimes.
Devil's advocate here.
Sometimes, but boredom has been, and managing boredom has been a bit of a life hack, really. In the early days, I was really bored. I had no idea what to do with my all this time I'd reclaimed. It's like between 20 and 30 hours a week. It's like, what do I do with this now? I'm not drinking. And anything I did, there was endless DIY. And even that is just never fun. I just thought I'd better find productive ways of filling my time. Hobbies that I'd formerly had didn't seem to bring any joy, certainly not that was comparable to that initial euphoria I got from the first few swigs of supermarket vodka. But that, again, that's the impact of alcohol on the brain. It causes something called anhedonia, which is an inability to experience joy. Without alcohol, once you've stopped it, you've struggled to experience pleasure in things that you'd usually experience pleasure in because of the alcohol, and that adjusts itself, and you actually find new ways of spending your time. So I would, in the first month, I would be often telling myself, I'd rather be bored than hungover. I'd rather be bored than dead. It's like, I don't want to throw a tantrum about being bored, because in perspective, in the context, boredom was a nice problem to have. Boredom wasn't chaos. It wasn't apologizing to people. It wasn't losing my job, losing my relationships, losing my driving license. Boredom wasn't causing my life to fall apart, and I could learn to deal with it like a grown-up. In fact, going sober, is a lot of it has been learning to become a grown-up. A lot of it has been learning to be a parent to myself. I think I'm not a parent, but the things that parents do for their kids, like making sure that they eat well, making sure that they get some exercise, making sure that they've run around enough so that they're tired before bed and get some sleep. We're very good at doing these to developing humans, but we need to be doing them to ourselves. We're no different as adults. I mean, we should eat properly. We should not smoke, not drink, make sure we're tired before bed, do our chores. And it's a lot easier to parent a child than it is to parent ourselves. But that's something I'm still learning.
I really like that. That's really lovely. Michael, can we talk about alcohol and mental health?
Yes.
And where that took you. And we like Ben said, we're going to do a bit of jumping around. We're going to go back, and then we'll come back to the present day and talk about, obviously, the positives of removing alcohol upon your mental health. But what impact did it have on you when it wasn't going great?
Well, of course, at the time, I would deny that alcohol was responsible for any impact on my mental health. I was just a normal person navigating life. I thought that people talked about mental health too much and probably just a bunch of snowflakes. And I even told my apprentice at the time, I had an apprentice, I said, if you ever find me talking and blogging about mental health, then feel free to shoot me. You just need to go to the pub like everybody else. And I'm hoping he's not going to hold me to that, because I have talked and done blog posts and things about mental health, and I do now worry for my own safety. At the time, my mental health was in absolute tatters. I've struggled with depression since I was a teenager, been on and off of meds, and strangely, the meds I've discovered work a lot better when you take them with water instead of a litre of vodka. And it's just crazy, that, isn't it? It's like, it's amazing that if you, this little tiny tablet I take every day, it isn't powerful enough to withstand a litre of depressant every night. So yes, the meds worked. The antidepressants worked when I wasn't drowning them with depressants. And I gave them a bit of time, and I made some changes to my life so that I didn't have the same dramas to deal with. For me, in the end, I was put under the care of the mental health team. It seems like utter insanity now. I don't know why it didn't seem insane at the time, but I'd be drinking to the extent that I just wanted to die, either before I went to bed or when I woke up. And I didn't have the nerve to actually see it through most of the time. I'd taken a few overdoses, obviously didn't work. And I was going to bed with a knife under my pillow quite a lot, which is absolutely, like, that is alarming to me now. But it's like, well, if I wake up in the middle of the night and I'm feeling brave, I might just finally do it. So I don't, and it's at hand then. If I just feel the urge, I can just finish it off. I might wake up feeling braver than I've gone to bed. And so I was just waking up with a knife under my pillow. And it's like, oh, well, woken up again. There's another failure. And that seems now to me to be incredibly disturbing and very sad. But clearly that's where alcohol had, well, it's hard to say. Is that where alcohol had taken my mental health, or is that where mental health had led me to alcohol? It's just it's a vicious cycle. They feed each other, and it's a spiral that sucks you in. I've had various interactions with mental health services. Always there's been alcohol involved at some point, and I'll end up at the psychiatric unit. And I, since I stopped drinking, haven't been back. You know, I'm still on medication, but the meds work because I'm not drowning them. And I've had some low periods, but I've got over them, and a lot quicker than I, you know, they might, my longest sort of stretch of depression has probably been about 3 months, which for me is, it would be years before. And I've found ways of getting myself out of them. So yeah, it's the most positive thing I've done to help my mental health. I'm able to notice when I'm not feeling well. Because I'm sitting with my feelings, a much overused phrase, but you know, I notice it. I don't just feel crap and then drink and become unconscious. I can actually think, oh, what's going on here? And what have I done before that's helped this? Instead of just hitting the bottle and making everything worse. I mean, trying to cheer yourself up with alcohol, and it's like trying to put out a fire with petrol, really. If you've got bad mental health, you're not going to put out that fire with petrol. You need some water. I mean, alcohol is the only flammable liquid I think people drink, isn't it? So, I mean, generally,
I've never
a good rule
of
thumb surely should be is do not drink flammable liquids. And yeah, I found that not drinking flammable liquids has some benefits.
Unbelievable. Honestly, I've never even thought of it like that. When you say it out loud, it sounds ridiculous. How does it make you feel now talking about that previous version of you when you were just so, so sad and in such a bad place?
Sad and angry. I was a sad and angry little man. I suppose I don't feel... I feel sorry for him. See, like, I'm talking like it's a different person. I mean, we do have the capacity to change, and I don't feel like I'm that person now. That's a previous version of myself. There's still lots of things we have in common. Sadly, we're still very chaotic, you know, both of us. but I feel sorry for him. But maybe I had to go through that to become who I am today. So I've had a lot of regrets. I've had a lot of beating myself up for things I did, people I hurt. And I made a conscious decision to draw a line under that and say, yeah, no one's benefiting from me hating myself anymore. No amount of self-loathing is going to make me a better person. In fact, I think you can't grow from a place of shame. So I made a conscious effort to draw a line under the shame, because I want to actually have some worth in society. And I can only do that by accepting that the past is the past and moving on and trying to be a better person today. And I'm not going to do that if I'm just lingering in self-resentment.
Michael, do you think that you and old you, do those two people have the same core? You know, do they share values? Is there a kind of, are there, yes, similarities there that are kind, yeah, of the inbuilt things. Can you explain it a bit more, what you mean?
I think my values are pretty much the same as they always were. The difference, I suppose, is since I've stopped drinking, I'm able to live up to them. So I always thought I was kindness, respect to others, family, all these things were important to me. But when I drank, I didn't live up to those values because I was paralyzing the part of my brain that made sound moral judgments. You shut off the parts of the brain that make you human when you drink, and you end up with just using the same parts of your brain as a lizard uses to navigate the world. You're in a fight and flight response. Your main preoccupations are for survival and reproduction. So it's, I want food, I want water, I want sex, I want to avoid danger. And so it can make you fight, it can make you aggressive, it can make you run away from the world, and it can make you copulate, kind of. It increases your desire to. So all these animalistic parts of our brain are still intact. And the things that separate us from most other animals, the things that weigh up judgments, the things that lead to good decisions, moral decisions, those are shut off. So it's very difficult, I believe, if you're drinking heavily, to live up to your values, because your values go out the window after you've paralyzed that part of your brain.
So in a way, new you is the person that old you wish that they could be.
Yeah, exactly that.
And isn't that
maybe not successful? Yet, you know, it's a work in progress. Well, success wasn't exactly that important to me. I didn't know what it was, but I'm definitely more at peace with myself as well. Old me was more competitive and felt like I was trying to, you know, compete with everyone in the world. I'm just happy now to get by with a small number of friends. Now I've got a modest home. And I'm not competing against anyone. And what anybody else gets up to is not so much my business. I've got a small circle of friends that I'm happy with, and I try to do a bit of good in the world. And I'm much more accepting of who I am. I don't try and hide parts of myself, or I don't try to project certain. I was projecting sort of things that weren't really my true self. I was masking like all this suffering, I suppose, I had. I was suffering silently and trying to project that I was living a perfectly normal and successful life, and it was completely insincere and inauthentic. And now I just tried to be myself, and if people can like it or lump it, but at least I'm being more authentic. I'm not hiding behind a mask or trying to project something that is not me.
I'm going to ask you a question now. Sorry, Ben. No, go on, Ben. No, you carry on.
I'll let you jump in, because that's the bit in your email that really jumped out at me, actually, Michael. You say, I want to share my story because to the outside world, I was just another normal person who liked to drink. I learned what to show the world and what to hide. And this is the bit that really got me. And I know there are many, many more like me. How many people are doing that now as we speak? Projecting a version of themselves that isn't true, isn't authentic, is trying to hide.
Well, I've had friends who you would not suspect of having a drinking problem contact me privately, sort of on social media and things. And they've said, oh, Michael, can you give us some advice? And it's like, these people are, you know, lawyers, nurses, people who work in like the health profession, who'd have thought, you know, knew a bit about these things. And they've private messaged me. They're not publicly asking anything. They're not acknowledging publicly that they have some concerns about their own drinking. And that's because there's still such stigma around not being able to handle your drink, which I think is it's a horrible game we play. as a society, that we encourage people to drink and then judge them if we judge them if they can't drink much. And then if they drink too much, we then go and judge them that they've got a problem. I don't know how you win this one. And I think this is particularly nasty in a work context as well. Work do's awful. Awful. They always used to fill me with absolute dread because you encourage the drink because that's team building. And then, but if you act drunk at any point and do actions and misbehave as a result of drinking, well, then you're still representing the company and there's severe repercussions, aren't there? So there's just such a horrible game to play.
And if you don't drink, you're singled out and
you're
fun
a party
at.
Pooper.
Not so we can only drink the perfect amount.
Exactly.
As a society.
Moderately.
Yeah.
Ben, drink responsibly, drink moderately.
It's
what you meant to do.
Encourage to get drunker and drunker whilst acting as if you are not drunk.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Why? Yeah. What sort of nasty game is that?
When you put it like that, like that's the unplugging yourself from the Matrix bit, isn't it? Where you look in and you go, this is nuts. This is
someone brings another tray of shots and says, oh, drank far too much, made a fool of himself. Well, what the bloody hell did you expect?
What did you think was going to happen? Yeah, you're so right. You're so right, Michael.
I've got a bizarre question for you now.
I like
this. The giggle made me really excited about this question.
No, I wonder if this was uncovered in sobriety or if this has always been the case. So I have followed Michael's Insta account, Happy Without the Hooch, for what feels like ages and ages and ages, and we'll talk more about that, you know, as we get to the end of the episode. Have you always been dead funny, or did you sort of discover that in sobriety? I think you are bloody hilarious on that account, and I don't know if you know how funny you are, but were you always like that, or has that come with a renewed confidence? You've discovered exactly who you are. Just share a bit about that, if you wouldn't mind. And if you think it's a weird question, soz.
I think it's just a manifestation of the terrible mental health, to be honest.
Fair dues. Fair dues. I know a lot of people like that.
You know, when like the work clown, who everyone calls mad, turns out to have actual, genuine mental health problems. Yeah, I think that's it. But no, I suppose people have found me funny, some people, not always. So, you know, people always have different senses of humour. But I've never really believed it. I've used humour as a form of deflection, I suppose.
Okay.
Most of my life. I've always tried to get out of, like, if I feel uncomfortable, or I've used humour. I've used humour to get out being beaten up before. It's been quite helpful, but it's part of people pleasing as well, trying to get people to like me, because if people like you, then they're not going to hurt you, are they? So I'd get bullied quite a lot as a kid, teenager growing up, part of that sort of being, I was quite a camp kid and camp teenager, and I remember there's this other lad who was threatening to beat me up, and I just used humour to embarrass him, make everyone else laugh, and I walked away. So, and I was thinking, this is really quite helpful, this part, because you don't want generally go around beating up people you like. So I used it to win friends, and also as a form of protection. And then I've used it to deflect. If I've embarrassed myself, I'll try and make it funny. If I've done something bad, let's use the humour again. So it's been a useful tool, but it's not always great if you're trying to be sincere. I'm trying to learn to be sincere more. And one of the things I've been trying to do since stopping drinking is trying to avoid any sort of humour that's a bit cruel. I could often use humour to deflect onto other people. So it's like if I feel people are looking at me, I'd use humour to deflect and point the finger elsewhere so that somebody else is getting it.
But I actually think you laugh at yourself a lot. You take the rip out of yourself a lot. With that, and that's all I've ever seen. And since I started on this whole alcohol-free journey, I've laughed a lot in sobriety. Like the most I've ever laughed. It has been a hell of a ride. Cried a fair bit as well in the early days, you know, to be brutally honest. But I think a sense of humour in sobriety when you're starting out on this nonsense, I think it's essential. And taking the rip out yourself, which is what you do.
Yeah, well, you've got to really, haven't you? I think it can be a bit too serious sometimes. But luckily, I found that just because I've stopped drinking, my life isn't necessarily much less chaotic. That, you know, I had the compulsory ADHD diagnosis, like, oh, no one's surprised. And I still can't keep the bedroom tidy, you know. I'm trying to parent myself, but
failing at that one.
I'm at my partner's place helping him do his place up at the moment. That's why it looks like it's been in here 2 days so far, but it's already tidier than mine. It's like I'm moving in to avoid tidying my own bedroom. And there is a lot of funny stuff that happens in sobriety. I've still managed to, I think one of my worst moments, one of my most embarrassing moments, was I was in the charity shop. I love a bit of charity shop sort of hunting. That's a good cheap hobby. And there was a pair of lederhosen in there. And I thought, I've got to try these on, because you don't see a pair of lederhosen and not try them on, do you?
No.
I wasn't decided that I actually needed a pair of lederhosen in my life, but I wanted to try them. So I went into the changing room, tried them on. They were a bit tight. In fact, they were far too tight, but I got them on. Problem was, I then couldn't get them off. I was in the age concern, stuck in a pair of lederhosen. And so my partner was with me. I was like, come over, help me get out these leather trousers. And so he comes into the changing room and he's tugging. And then this has then raised a bit of concern among the staff, who now have seen these two men sort of in the changing room, and they come along to check what's going on. And then they start trying to remove the trousers from me. So now the curtain's been moved back. I've got my partner and two members of staff, now me in front of everyone, trying to pull these leather trousers off me. And there's this blue rinsed gaggle in the shop who are all just looking over and laughing as I'm absolutely humiliated and red faced. And it was horrific, but also incredibly funny. And I'm so glad that you don't have to be drunk to still completely embarrass yourself publicly. And you can laugh at it. I didn't die. I didn't hurt anyone. I just got stuck in a pair of lederhosen. And I'm...
Did you buy them?
But he's still wearing them today, Shaz. He's still wearing them now.
How compelled is that? If you find yourself in a similar scenario, get the old talcum powder out.
Michael, yeah, feel free to say, no thanks, we'll move on from this question. And we will. But do you feel like you still use humour as a bit of a defence mechanism today?
Yes. Yeah, it's still I think it's ingrained. But I have to be just mindful of it. I think it has a purpose. If you're using it constantly to deflect and you're never confronting or any of your real sort of issues in life, that's a problem. But you don't have to tell everybody everything all of the time. If you've got people you can confide in and you can talk about these things, then that's okay. I've got several people now that if I'm just feeling down or something's bothering me, I can pick up the phone and call them. I can meet them up for a cup of tea. I'd never have done that before. And I do that, and I don't feel any shame in it. It doesn't hurt my ego to have problems. As I always used to try and show that I didn't have any problems in life. Like from the age of 18, I moved out of home and I struggled with lots of things financially and relationships and everything. But I thought it was very important to show that I was an adult who could handle the world, even though I was, you know, getting up to my ears in debt and a terrible relationship. But I would never ask, like, I wouldn't say, Dad, I've got behind on my utility bills. I mean, could you lend me? It was my own pride would just stopped me from ever acknowledging, letting anyone see that my life was difficult, like most people's are. But I'm able to talk openly now about problems I have and then confront them, instead of necessarily, well, sometimes I bury my head in the sand for a bit too much longer, but eventually I'll pull it out and deal with things. And there's people who can help me along the way, and I help them. So I didn't feel, I suppose I didn't really help anyone before. And so asking for help would probably seem a bit rich, but I try and help people and they help me back. And it's just so much easier that way. I've got actual friends, which is a real bonus, because I didn't really have anyone I was drinking. I had people I could drink with, but I didn't have friends. And drinking in the end became just the most isolating, loneliest experience I could have. I stopped going out because it was too dangerous going out, because it would end in hospitals and I just wouldn't get home. I'd live quite close to Southend High Street, but often I wouldn't make it back. I would just wake up on the high street or on a roundabout, and we'd be on CCTV, and that my colleagues who worked in the CCTV unit would see. And I just drank at home on my own most of the time in the end. It was just, well, I don't have to worry about getting home if I've never left it. And if I do anything stupid, well, no one's going to see because I'm on my own. Instead of thinking, oh, well, how about you don't drink? It was like, well, obviously the drinking's going to stay. I just won't do the socializing part with it. Because if you have a drink sometimes, and this is something my partner said to me before, and it really resonated. He said, well, sometimes when I drink, it feels like company. And it's like, ooh, that's painful. This, because he's also on his own journey. He's had a very abusive relationship with alcohol. And he stopped about 18 months after I did, but it got worse before he stopped. And some of the things he said in the past have really stuck with me. There might have been throwaway comments. But he's struggled with alcohol and depression and mental health. And one thing he said that was really important to me was when he was struggling, he said, I either want to die or have a real shot at life. And I thought, well, those are absolute polar opposites. It's like they couldn't be further apart. And I've always loved a bit of Shawshank Redemption. So it sort of reminded me of the whole sort of get busy living or get busy dying. And I thought, you know what, instead of just half-heartedly trying to accelerate my death, how about just having a real shot of life first? I mean, you can always go and kill yourself afterwards if it doesn't work. That can be your backup plan. But why not actually put everything you have into having a good, like a shot at life, and just see what happens? Just see what happens without any expectations or preconceptions. And that's how I try and approach most things now, as an experiment. Just see what happens. Keep an open mind, because I didn't think I was going to be able to stop drinking. I'd made all these I had these stupid beliefs, like, I'm an alcoholic because it runs in my blood, you know. The whole mum side of the family, long history of alcohol abuse. If you cut my veins open, I'd bleed whiskey. So I didn't think that was going to be possible. And in the end, I thought, well, I'll just suspend the belief and see what happens. Treat it like an experiment. And I've tried to apply that to other areas of my life. You talked about sense of humor. One of the things I realized pretty quickly after I stopped drinking was that I wasn't particularly good in social situations. Anxiety was, I'd walk into a group of people I didn't know and I just felt ridiculously anxious. And it's like, I feel exactly like I did as a teenager, and I learned that once I had a drink, it all went away. But now I can't drink. I've got two options. I can either hide myself away forever, doesn't sound like much fun, or I can try and do something about the anxiety by repeatedly scaring myself. And so I thought, well, what would fill me with absolute dread? And the idea of going up on a stage and trying to be funny filled me with absolute dread. And there's a comedy group in Southend, is a comedy school for improv comedy. I'd found myself accidentally, thanks to my superpower of ADHD, attending one of their events. I turned up a week early for a networking event. And in fact, when I sort of turned up in my suit and everything and found that when I got there, it was an improv comedy night. And they,
so I thought, of course it was.
I thought, well, I'm here now, so I might as well watch it. So I sat down and watched the comedy, and then they were selling the course at the end. And I thought, you know what? Why not give it a go? That sounds absolutely terrifying. Count me in, because if it. I can get through that and, you know, try and be funny in front of a paying audience, then I can probably get through things that are less scary. I've done public speaking before against my will. Absolutely terrifying. You could see me physically shaking all the way through. And I failed my driving test 4 times because as soon as I was in the test condition, I was so panicky that I lost control of my limbs. My feet were just shaking on the pedals. I just had no control because nerves were so bad. So I thought, you know what? If I can survive that, even if I'm not funny, if I can humiliate myself in public, which won't be as bad as the way I used to humiliate myself in public before when I was drinking, and get through it, then I will be a little less nervous next time. And before I went on the stage the first time, I noticed the other people who were also first timers downing pint to give themselves courage, shaking, really nervous, because they'd obviously put some pressure on themselves that they had to be funny. I was like, nope, all I have to do is go up there, not die, and I'll end up a bit stronger. And I, for the first time, I was expecting to be terrified. I just was absolutely calm and collected. And as a result of that, actually, I wasn't too bad. I wasn't the worst person there that night. There was people a lot more experienced who were a lot better, but it went well. And so I thought, I'll do that again. And so, yeah, I've been trying to scare myself, push myself to do things I think I won't like, push myself to do things that I'm not naturally good at and do them anyway, including that horrible running you mentioned. I'm still bad at it, but I'm doing it anyway.
I've got to just flag this up quickly because I realise we're just about out of time. And when we were messaging last night, Michael, I know you wanted to get to the gym after this recording. So if you've got time, will you
make
it?
Don't worry, I've already taken it. I've already decided I'm going to be late for it.
Right, well, we'll wrap it up very quickly. One thing that really made me howl on one of your reels or Insta stories, I don't know what it was, but you asked the question, am I now a running wanker? Have you had an answer to that, Michael?
Yeah, I think I am. I am a running wanker. It's inevitable. I had absolutely zero intention of starting running. I see all these sober people starting running. I think I'd be like, what are you doing that for? Just because you're not drinking doesn't mean you have to become some sort of bloody health guru. I mean, I was smashing back 5 bags of Haribo a night, and I put on 4.5 stone. I was ordering pizzas. I was enjoying myself. I used to really watch what I ate when I was drinking because I wanted to reserve my calories for the alcohol. Yeah. And then I let it all go. I thought, well, I can eat what I like now. Also, you can spend what you like because I got this completely mythical budget called money I've saved by not drinking.
Yes, I have the same budget.
Yeah. And I've got this app that tells me how much I've saved. Yep. Unfortunately, there's no withdrawal button on that app. And my bank tells me that I've never been in so much debt. But I tend to forget to factor in the fact that I've got a much lower paid job now, you know, having lost jobs and got into debt. I mean, I had an ankle tag just when I was 40. How embarrassing is that? So I forget to factor these things in, and I just got really fat and poor. And then earlier this year, I decided I was doing the laundry and I got puffed out, taking the clothes from my bedroom to the washing machine. And I thought, this isn't right. I shouldn't be puffed out doing laundry. And I'd get puffed out just walking up the steps to my flat. It's only on the first floor. So I thought, I'd better do something about this. And I got a PT and I said, I don't mind what I do, as long as I'm not running. That was actually a stipulation. I said, don't make me run. I'm not going to run. I don't run for the bus or the train. I just accept that I've missed it as I see it disappear in the distance and wait for the next one. The only times I'm running is if I'm being pursued by a predator. and then he did, however, give me a daily step count. And I was enjoying the walking, but I was finding, like, working from home, I wasn't really building up any steps during the day. And then I'd have to do all my walking either before work or after work. And to get to that number of steps, it was taking too long. It's like, oh, now I've got to cook. And it's like, all I'm doing is working and walking. So I had this genius idea that I could try doing the steps a bit quicker to get them out of the way so I could go on and do things I actually wanted to do. And doing steps quicker is very similar to running.
Yeah.
And so I started doing the couch to 5K so that I could get my personal steps out of the way quicker. And yeah, first time I got up to nearly, I had to add a week before couch to 5K because your first week they expect you to run for a whole minute and I could only get to 30 seconds. So I added a week of getting to 30 seconds first. And then it just got out of hand. It's a bit like how you two did your, you had your own sober challenge 1 or 3 months, whatever, and then it got out of hand.
Yeah, it gets out of hand.
You get these flashes of inspiration, don't you? Like, for example, I'm going to do the Three Peaks, National Three Peaks Challenge. And you even, in that flash of inspiration, set up a Just Giving page and you ask for donations. And then that flash of inspiration goes and you go, what the bloody hell am I doing that for?
Why the hell? See, I've realised just because you give up drinking doesn't mean you have to stop making terrible decisions that you immediately
regret. Yeah, very true.
And it doesn't mean you have to stop doing things that make you feel awful. I think part of me just misses waking up feeling like an absolute dung heap. And so I will just physically punish myself for absolutely no reason now. It could be by having a vindaloo. I find that's quite good. If you're missing feeling crap in the morning, just have a curry that's far too hot for you at the weekend. or run further than your body's supposed to run. And I've signed up for my half marathon, of course.
Of course you have.
5K, and I'm now meant to be doing a half marathon in November. I still haven't run that far in my life. And I think I've half agreed to doing a marathon in March. But I haven't, I haven't made that public, but I kind of have done by speaking to you now, haven't I?
Well, it's now out there, Michael, and we are delighted to be sharing that news that you have gone from a couch potato to running an actual marathon. And you are a fully fledged, in your words, running wanker.
I don't particularly like running still.
Well, who does?
I'm going to say that. I don't enjoy
fast
it.
Walking.
I enjoy having run.
Yes, yeah.
I like the bragging rights. And I'm still not convinced you can call it running because it's so bloody slow.
It doesn't matter.
It's not much faster than a walk. It just involves extra hip pain.
Michael, it's been an absolute pleasure. And I've just looked at the clock and our community members are going to be joining this Zoom. Well, not this Zoom. We've got another Zoom. So we are very sadly going to have to wrap this up. Quickly, before you go, Michael, if people want to follow you on social media, just give your socials a plug.
I'm on Instagram predominantly, Happy Without the Hooch. Also on Facebook. That's it. I think I am technically on other channels, but I can't log on to them all.
Michael, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for joining us on Over the Influence.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. It's been a delight.